Is general aviation at a tipping point? And if it is, what do we do about it? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller, CFI, publisher of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, which is available on the internet. We're here to talk about safety issues and some of the points raised in Bob's newsletter, which occasionally, more than occasionally, kind of rattles the bars of the aviation establishment. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
As always, Paul, it's my pleasure.
Bob, you wrote an article in your current edition of Over the Airwaves about a tipping point. And I think that this this term has come into everyone's vernacular as a result of the financial crisis. We know that the financial industry, all the Wall Street firms, cruised along just fine until they got to a certain point where they all kind of got in trouble at the same time. People in their home mortgages, in some cases, are struggling with the same thing where, you know, everything went along fine. They could cover their bills. But when one person either lost a job or had a reduction in income, suddenly couples were losing their homes. You find a tipping point in general aviation that you see on the horizon. Explain that to our listeners.
Well, I think there's a couple of tipping points, and these are, again, almost subliminal factors that go on in any industry. It might be a book that is a sleeper for many months and all of a sudden takes off and becomes a number one bestseller, even though it's been on the market for maybe a couple of years or more, or a movie, or any kind of a trend that all of a sudden takes wings and becomes so significant, it really captures attention. And it can be both positive, such as a best-selling book, and it can be negative, such as a disease that turns into a full-fledged epidemic. I think that that we have two things going on in general aviation that have been going on for an awful long time, and I know I sound like I'm beating the drum constantly on these two issues. But the first one is the fact that we're still suffering far too many fatal accidents in general aviation. And if most of these fatal accidents were a result of equipment failure or acts of God, that would be one thing. But 80% of these fatal accidents are due to pilot error or pilot factors. And the fatal accident rate, although it's statistically moving up and down each year, over the last 10 years, it remains essentially unchanged, and just about anywhere between 66 and 100 times more deadly than flying on an airliner. And each time we have a fatal accident in a community, it turns off that community to general aviation for a number of days and sometimes weeks and even months, depending on the profile of the victims on board that airplane. Well, one community turned off to general aviation doesn't hurt us too badly, but when we suffer 275 fatal wrecks in any given year throughout the United States, the long-term negative effect on general aviation reaches, in fact, what we call a tipping point or an intolerance. Let me give you another quick comparison. You mentioned the financial crisis. You know, executives for big Fortune 100 companies have been receiving bonuses for decades, mm-hmm. for centuries. But we see with the abuses over at AIG, all of a sudden that reached a tipping point where executives that were receiving bonuses, their lives were being threatened by the outrage of some members of the public. That's a tipping point that had been achieved. And I think one of the two tipping points in general aviation continues to be our fatal accident rate.
The first question is, how will we define or know this tipping point, or what will it be?
Well, at some point, somebody's going to stand up, whether it's a congressman or a mayor, as we see in the city of Chicago, are going to start seriously enacting legislation that says, you know, these small airplanes are just too dangerous to operate in controlled airspace. We need to keep them, I'm using this, what everybody might think is an absurd example, but I don't think it's too far away when they say there shall be no small airplanes flying over congested areas. At some point, you know, there's going to be just enough outrage where the community is going to rise up and say no. And usually that is preceded by national media attention, where the media gets on board and starts really proclaiming the alleged hazards and dangers of general aviation. That's how it starts. And then when it does start, we may find ourselves 10 years from now restricted to Class G and Class E airspace only. We'll have to stay away from the Class C airports and the Class B airports. And that, unless, say, we're on an IFR flight plan, well, that wipes out about half the general aviation pilots. This can be precluded. This can be stopped. And I truly believe that our spokespeople, the people who claim to represent us, need to take a much more proactive stand and work with the community, work with the industry to do something very specific about the fatal accident rate.
Well,
now, you know, they're going to claim that, well, they're doing everything they can. They're sending, you know, videos out. They're having safety seminars. But it's the old adage that Phil Boyer used to say, you know, we can lead a horse to water, but we can't make him drink. We know right now that we're reaching, at best, 15% of the pilot population with these programs. The other 85% are not responding.
Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk about the specifics that you mentioned in your newsletter about what we can do, because obviously if we get into a situation where we're limited from flying in much of the nation's airspace in general aviation aircraft, that'll be a much more onerous thing than any of the fixes that are considered onerous by today's standards. My guest is Bob Miller. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, talking about tipping points and how we may run the risk of reaching one in general aviation, where the concerns of people on the ground start to limit our freedoms on where we can fly in the air. Bob, you had some very specific things you mentioned in this edition of Over the Airwaves that we could do as a community to put that day off, improve our accident record in a meaningful way.
Well, we know that an old principle of education tells us that if a student failed to learn, it's because the teacher failed to teach. And right now, one of the major problems, I think it's almost a foundational problem in our accident rate, is we can trace back 80% of the accidents to pilot error, pilot judgment errors, pilot factors. And where are these errors promulgated? Where do they begin? They begin, in my opinion, through the primacy of learning. What they failed to learn as primary students. And that results from the fact that many of our flight instructors are simply not qualified to be teaching. If we just imagine the following scenario, if we applied the same standards to A&Ps, aircraft and airframe and pilot power plant mechanics with an inspection authorization, had those standards used the CFI standards to achieve that IA rating, you can just imagine what the mechanical condition of our airplanes would be. Let me be more specific. For an A&P to have an inspector authorization privilege attached to his certificate, he needs to be a practicing A&P for 3 full years, full-time, which translates to a minimum of 6,000 hours of experience to approve an aircraft for flight. Yet a CFI, the way he's trained now, the way he comes through the system, he barely needs to have a little bit more than 10 or 15 hours total solo time, minimal, to become a CFI. No experience requirement beyond that other than to hold a commercial pilot certificate. The comparison between what's required to become an A&P or an A&P with an IA and a CFI is ludicrous. Why that happened? Perhaps it happened in the early days, pre-World War II, when we had to get a lot of pilots into the sky. But that same very, very low standard is with us today, and that clearly needs to change. That's one thing that we need to work on.
Well, let's talk about that one thing as the focus here, and we'll let our listeners read the other ones in over the airwaves. I always have the question when we talk about this topic, if we make these changes, where will CFIs come from? And let me just run down a couple of points that stick in my mind. You mentioned the example of a flight school where a student pays $65 an hour for the instructor, and the instructor ends up getting $10 of that. No experienced 3,000-hour pilot is going to work for $10 an hour. Let's get specific about this paradigm shift. What kind of flight school model do you set up which allows you to pay instructors what they're worth?
We have one. We have one that I started a year and a half ago. We're paying our flight instructors $35 an hour. My goal in doing that is to retain flight instructors. We have two airline pilots, two young individuals who have worked in the airlines, who were furloughed because of cutbacks due to the local, to the economy. And they're working for me at $35 an hour. Two of them in the month of March, when I combined their two payrolls together, earned a little over $14,000. That's $7,000 each in the month of March, which is not our big season here in the Northeast. When you look at that on an annualized basis, it's approaching $80,000 a year, which is just about what a senior captain makes flying for a regional airline. So that if we do pay a decent wage, we retain the best flight instructors. Those that apply to our flying school have no experience. We simply don't take them. They have to have the experience. They have to have line experience, and we'll pay them the fee. These individuals are hardworking instructors. They're committed to what we want to achieve in aviation. And I think if we could have each flight school, whether it's operating under Part 61 or Part 141, begin to do this, then we're going to see a noticeable change in the quality of skills, the quality of the pilots coming out of these flight schools.
Well, Bob, I appreciate you're getting specific, because that was what I was getting at. You're proving, I guess, that it can be done. If anybody has any questions for you on how your business model works, are you free with that, or is that somewhat proprietary?
No, we're absolutely an open book. One of the reasons I started the flight school was to prove to the community that you can make money in a flight school. You know, that's been one of these old wives' tales that are going around, that flight schools can't make money. You can make money, but you have to approach it as a businessman. I had one of my part-time instructors come in and lamented the fact that we had raised our fees to our students from $55 to $65 an hour. He was upset because he was trying to bring in some of his friends, and they didn't want to pay $65 an hour. And I said, we're prospering as a school, we're thriving, we're growing, we're operating new airplanes because we're operating like a business. We're not giving it away. Anything that operates on the cheap just doesn't exist. It will not survive. You have to, particularly when we're talking about lives and safety, I believe the industry will grow and thrive if we can eliminate the ultimate problem, and that is our fatal accident rate. I've been working with very indirectly with the folks that are hoping to revamp the Professional Flight Instructors Association SAFE, mm-hmm. And NAFI. And I've said, if we could just zero in on the fatal accident rate as our reason for existence and then work backwards from that, we can really achieve some noteworthy benefits for the industry.
All right,
I'm not sure they're listening.
Time will tell. I want to remind our listeners that if you have any comments on what Bob has said, you can email me at paulp@aero-news.net, and we'll take up your questions in a future edition of this podcast. Bob, as always, thanks for your time.
My pleasure, Paul.
Bob Miller has been my guest. You can find Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, at www.overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.